You are listening to the Holistic Travel Nurse Podcast. This is Naomi, your host, here to inspire, to encourage, and uplift you and give you tips to motivate your mind, body, soul, and spirit to live a healthier life, to take care of your health holistically. I'm all about approaching your life naturally, and I do that because I've worked, oh my gosh, way too many years in the Western medical care system, and I've seen the good and the bad of our healthcare system in the U.S. I mean, I got to the point where I hate walking into the hospitals, and it's just because I know we do great emergency care, but when it comes to taking chronic care of diseases, we don't do well. We don't tell people how to manage our health naturally. As a matter of fact, I think we hurt people with GMO food and easily fast-paced lifestyle and fast food and not thinking of nutrients and nourishing your bodies as God has intended it to do. Lately, I feel like I haven't been doing very well taking care of my own personal health because we have purchased a home that we are turning into an Airbnb and rehabbing it. Some of it ourselves, some of it like hiring people, getting the people to do the work you need to do, doing the work yourself and working full time and doing this podcast and doing my holistic health business where I have actually put in a massage table in this house where I can do aromatherapy and people, and I've had some clients. I'm excited about that. So if you're in the Texas area, central Texas area, you never know if I'm going to be here, but if I am, it's time to reach out to me. I'm recording this at end of June because I have not recorded anything in the longest time. And I'm going to share with you guys. I'm going to try to play this. There was just like, I haven't had time to like go into it. And I've been talking about cardiovascular health and personally being dealing with my husband's health and taking care of it naturally. And I'll dive more into what we've been doing and how it's been helping later. But I just wanted to, I found this, it's on YouTube and it's like had no views. And it was from 2018, and it is about our toxic metals, cardiovascular system, and renal disease. And I want to share this, and I want people to hear part of what they're saying. So I'm going to try to give you a little of this and share it, and hopefully you will get enough from it. So without ado, let's see if we can play this.
Which I participated both as a student and as a teacher, and there's a national meeting once a year in which this talk was given. ASIM's administrative director is Ann Sconyers, whose husband Gary is an internationally recognized naturopathic physician. The Sconyers practice in Dallas and they work closely with Dr. Cowden, and from time to time my patients will see them. When you see the Sconyers, you spend a week and you undergo a thorough evaluation. One of my patients was planning a week with the Sconyers, and his daughter was home for spring break. Her school got out at an unusual time, and none of her friends were going to be home, so she had a week with nothing to do, and as it's warmer in Dallas in March than it is in Detroit, she traveled to Dallas with her dad. Well, she's a rather attractive young lady, and the Sconyers have a son the same age, and he sometimes helps out at the office, so it was only natural they went on a date. The date went well, and they went on another date, and a year later they got married. So now, whenever we call the Sconyers, we identify ourselves as the daughter-in-law referral practice. When I gave this talk, my audience was a room full of like-minded integrated practitioners, and I had 70 minutes, and I went pretty fast. Most of you listening to this presentation are not physicians, and much of what I say may be new to you, but with this format, I have the luxury of time, and I'll do my best to explain the key points. Also, these topics are all covered in greater detail on our other presentations, available at the office or on heartfixer.com. At this point in my career, I spend 90% of my time working with patients, 5% teaching doctors, and 5% in research. Pertaining to this discussion, I was a principal investigator in TACT-1, which studied the use of magnesium EDTA chelation therapy in heart attack survivors, and we're currently involved in TACT-2, a follow-up study confined to diabetics who have experienced a heart attack. I'm going to begin our discussion of the role of toxic metals in cardiovascular and kidney disease by presenting our most important clinical trial, TACT-1. TACT is the trial to assess chelation therapy, we took just over 1,700 subjects. They were all clinically stable without a recent revascularization. They were at least 6 months out from their first heart attack. On average, they were 4.6 years out from their first heart attack. A third were diabetic. 40% had a larger anterior infarction involving the front wall of the heart. And within the TAC protocol, all the subjects received standard post-infarction, post-heart attack medical therapy. 73% were on statins. Their mean LDL was 89. Their mean fasting sugar was 102, so their sugar was under pretty good control. 84% on aspirin, 72% on a beta blocker, 63% were on an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker, and 83% had a prior revascularization, either a balloon angioplasty or stent placement. So what we did, all 1,708 subjects received 40 IV treatments over a year and a multivitamin, randomized as one half received IV ED chelation therapy, one half received a placebo solution, a bag of salt water, a half received a high potency multivitamin. This is a broad spectrum, 6-a-day vitamin and mineral supplement designed to minimize oxidative stress. The antioxidant vitamins don't prevent the generation of oxidative stress, but they will neutralize the free radicals. So antioxidant vitamin minerals neutralize oxidative stress. And half received a low potency multivitamin. So 25% of the patients received EDTA and a strong multivitamin. Our theory is that oxidative stress drives cardiovascular disease. By removing heavy metals, which are a cause of oxidative stress, we're decreasing the generation of free radicals. With the multivitamin, we're neutralizing any free radicals that are generated. 25% got double active therapy. 25% received EDTA and a weak multi, simply enough minerals to make up for minerals that might be washed out in association with the chelation process. 25% received an IV placebo and a strong multi, 25% received double placebo. So we could look for the independent and synergistic effects of chelation therapy, removing metals that cause oxidative stress, and vitamin mineral supplementation to neutralize free radicals that are generated. We looked at primary endpoints and secondary endpoints and followed these patients for 5 years. 38% of the patients that received placebo therapy experienced an adverse event, death, heart attack, stroke, coronary revascularization, or hospitalization with unstable angina over 5 years, which is pretty much what you'd expect. These patients had all had a heart attack, and we would expect them to have recurrent problems. 38% event rate over 5 years was expected. In the subject that received chelation therapy, the event rate was 33%. So there was an 18% risk reduction that was statistically significant, showing that chelation therapy, when added to standard medical therapy, decreases adverse event rate. Now you'll notice nothing happened for a year, and then the event rate curves begin to separate, and they continue to separate over time. Why did nothing happen early on? Because it takes time to turn the ship around. If you have high blood pressure and I give you a drug, your blood pressure may fall in a few days. But if you have atherosclerosis due to decades of untreated oxidative stress, to remove the cause of this undue oxidative stress, removing metals, you know, it took you decades to fill up your bone marrow with toxic metals and your soft tissue with toxic metals, it's going to take time to remove them. So when we are removing the cause of disease, this is a slow process, but we're slowly and persistently resolving the oxidative diathesis, the oxidative predisposition to atherosclerotic vascular disease. This takes time. All components of the primary endpoint were lessened: death, heart attack, stroke, need for repeat revascularization, and need for repeat hospitalization. With multivitamin therapy alone, so no, you're getting placebo IV and either double placebo or the active vitamin, there was a 3% risk reduction. This was not statistically significant by itself, but it supports our theory. And again, nothing happened for a year, and then the event rate curves begin to split. Now, the worst outcome was double placebo. They had the highest event rate. The best group, the best outcome was double active therapy, and this makes sense. We're removing the metals that generate undue oxidative stress, We're giving you vitamins and minerals to scarf up any free radicals that break through. You would anticipate there would be a synergy here, and indeed there was. The best outcome was chelation therapy with a high-potency vitamin mineral supplement. Now, those that had anterior infarctions, anterior wall heart attacks involving the left-hand ascending distribution, they lost more heart muscle. They are at greater risk for an adverse event. And here, chelation provided a greater degree of risk reduction, 37% five-year risk reduction. As a general rule, the larger the heart attack, the worse the natural history, the greater the upside potential, and the more powerful impact will any therapy have. So overall, there was an 18% risk reduction in those that had the larger anterior heart attacks. There was a 37% five-year reduction. The natural history of diabetics is worse than that of non-diabetics. If you're diabetic, you're generating a great deal of undue free radical stress, and chelation therapy lowered five-year event rate in the diabetic patients by 39%. Now, death rate fell by 43% with chelation therapy in the diabetic infarct survivors versus the diabetic infarct survivors that received placebo therapy. This is the event rate in the diabetics. It was nearly 50% at 5 years. Vitamins alone had no effect, and that's because the vitamins alone were not sufficient to neutralize the oxidative stress generated by being diabetic and having a heavy metal burden. Chelation, though, was quite effective, and tremendous synergy in this group. The best outcome was chelation therapy and high-dose vitamins. Again, there's a greater upside potential in the diabetics because they're generating free radicals. They have a metal burden. If we remove the metals and provide antioxidant vitamins, we're going to get the best outcome. So there was great synergy here. So synergy between metal detox and antioxidant support in the trial to assess chelation therapy, supporting our theory that oxidative stress is the key driver of atherosclerotic vascular disease. So ED chelation works in chronic coronary disease. This has now been demonstrated. How does it work? Which steps in atherosclerosis are attenuated? Which steps are not? What are the optimal concomitant therapies? Will metal detox and oxidative stress reduction benefit other organ systems? This is EDTA, a hexadentate chelator. We administer EDTA. It binds a metal in its active site, and then the EDTA metal complex is excreted either in the urine or through the liver. Let's talk a little bit about the steps of atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis begins when lipid particles enter the artery wall at sites of intimal activation and vulnerability. You have endothelial dysfunction, the vascular wall is more porous, the lipids can enter. That, of course, is not pathologic because every cell of the intima has an LDL receptor. LDL cholesterol is food. If the LDL does not bind an LDL receptor, it can swim right out. Unless the lipids are retained, phospholipases, which are upregulated in the presence of systemic inflammation, will minimally oxidize the phospholipids of the LDL, and then they clump together and they get trapped on proteoglycan that is composed of chondroitin sulfate. They're trapped, they can't swim out, and then free radicals generated by all the cells of the intima will oxidize the LDL, creating a protein structure not normally present in the human body. We are not tolerant to oxidized LDL. It is interpreted by our immune system as a bacterial invader, and thus we mount an acquired, skewed immune response against pseudo-infection of the artery wall with oxidized lipids, and that's the driving force of atherosclerosis when lipids become oxidized by excessive free radicals. Over the years, the vascular wall will thicken with progressive deposition of lipids, progressive infiltration of mononuclear cells, monocytes that become macrophages. Systemically, we see an increase in the generation of TH1 and TH17 immune inflammatory cytokines, immune mediators, and we see a reduction in regulatory cytokines. So the immune system is now in battle mode. We're not quieting things down. We think that we're experiencing a chronic bacterial infection of the vascular wall, but it's really a pseudo-infection with oxidized lipids, and our immune system generates all these inflammatory cytokines that generate more inflammation, more oxidative stress, and the plaque thickens and becomes unstable. Finally, we have the terminal event at a shoulder region of the plaque. a region that is characterized by excessive oxidative stress, matrix metalloproteinases elaborated by macrophages under the influence of interferon gamma released by activated T cells will be processed by chymase released by activated mast cells, and then you'll degrade the fibrous cap. The atherosclerotic gruel will flow out into the flow lumen, and you'll have a heart attack. And this is really an acute severe imbalance between the ability to neutralize free radicals and the generation of free radicals. We have plaque rupture and oxidative inflammatory bonfire. We want to prevent this. And if we're going to prevent this, we need to deal with the causes, the risk factors, the abnormalities in vascular biochemistry and cell biology that allowed this process to begin and which allows this process to progress and perpetuate. And of course, key here is oxidative inflammatory stress.
All right. I did not talk about this guy. His YouTube channel is James Robert. This is a 2-hour lecture. I'm not going to share it all. I'm going to speed for it and give you a little more. He goes into these slides that are really great. And I just want to talk about things that he's saying during this moment. He says, you see more of this happening with the heart and the inflammation and this is a long process. With the last not having enough antioxidants and vitamins and minerals, efficient in certain vitamins and minerals and omega-3s, deficient in vitamin K2 and vitamin D, and methyl donors. So people that are overweight have hypertension, deficiency in coenzyme 10, carotene, magnesium, insulin insensitivities, insulin resistance, other toxics, having high homocysteine levels, smoking, trans fat, having a lot of irons and heavy metals in your body, oxidative stress, organic pollutants, air pollution. So those are just some of the things. And I'm just going to speed this up and give you a little bit more of some science. And then if you wanted to watch his whole thing and geek out, I will put the link below.
Is food. LDL is a protein, apolipoprotein B100, containing a sac of cholesterol and triglycerides and cholesterol ester. The outer wall of the apolipoprotein B100 is studded with phospholipids. And the rheologic characteristics, the flow characteristics of the LDL, depend upon the quantity and quality of the phospholipids in its outer wall. But every cell of the intima needs LDL. Every cell has an LDL receptor. If the cells don't need cholesterol, they withdraw their LDL receptor. Remember, we have that SCAP-SRE interaction. If the endothelial cells don't need cholesterol, they're going to withdraw their LDL receptor. So if there's no cells with an open LDL receptor, the LDL will wash out of the artery wall unless it is modified and trapped. Now, what happens is phospholipases like phospholipase A2, phospholipase D, lipoproteinase that are activated in the presence of systemic inflammation will oxidize the phospholipids coating the LDL, and then they'll clump together. And they clump together and they bind to chondroit sulfate in proteoglycan, the ground substance of the artery, and they're trapped and they can't get out, and then they're subjective to oxidative stress. So phospholipase A2 breaks one bond, phospholipase D makes another bond, making lysophosphatidylcholines, which are inflammatory in nature. So here we're going to look at phospholipase D activation in bovine, that's cattle-derived endothelial cells. And here we will see that if you incubate these endothelial cells with three different species of mercury, mercury chloride, methylmercury that you would get from fish, Thimerosal, which is in vaccines, you can see that there is a dose and time-related activation of phospholipase D, suggesting that mercury will activate phospholipase D, causing minimal oxidation of the phospholipids of the LDL, causing them now to clump together on the chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan and get trapped. Now, vitamin C will to some degree attenuate mercury-induced phospholipase activation. Vitamin C will squelch superoxide. Mercury causes oxidative stress to generate superoxide. A more effective therapy is N-acetylcysteine, which contains a thiol group, a sulfhydryl group, and N-acetylcysteine supports glutathione. Glutathione is a specific chelator of mercury, so you can see that N-acetylcysteine was more effective than vitamin C because it upregulates the generation of glutathione, which will bind and remove mercury. EDTA, a strong chelator of lead, aluminum, and cadmium, blocks mercury-induced phospholipase deactivation to some degree. DMSA, a specific mercury chelator, does a better job. So if you remove the mercury, and if you generate glutathione to help remove the mercury, you'll block mercury-induced phospholipase activation, at least in this animal model. And we want to do that because if we have hyperlipidemia, if we have a porous, leaky vascular wall, if the lipids are minimally oxidized and trapped on the proteoglycan, they can't swim out, they're stuck there, and they're subject to oxidative stress by free radicals. A free radical is an atom with one as opposed to two electrons in its outer shell. It is unstable and reactive. It'll snatch an electron from the next atom, quenching its thirst, but forming a new radical. And one by one, all the atoms will be damaged, the cell will be damaged, the organ will be damaged, and we get sick. Atherosclerosis and all of our age-related degenerative diseases are driven by oxidative stress. Where do these free radicals come from? Well, within the vascular wall, enzyme systems of the normal cells of the vascular wall, the endothelial cells, resident white cells, the macrophages, vascular smooth muscle cells, will all generate free radicals via their housekeeping enzymes, such as NADPH oxidase, xanthine oxidase, angiotensin converting enzyme, cyclooxygenase, myeloperoxygenase. We'll talk about them a little bit later in other talks. If we call in mononuclear cells to investigate this irregularity that Mother Nature is noting, this potential infection, they're going to make free radicals. But the big problem, the pathological source of oxidative stress in the vascular wall, is our burden of heavy metals and organic pollutants. So these lipids, once they're trapped, they're subject to undue oxidative stress. And this creates oxidized LDL, the driving force of atherosclerosis. The immune system recognizes oxidized LDL not as food, but as a microbe. And we will acquire a chronic inflammatory response. The atherosclerotic plaque is a slowly growing boil that eventually ruptures and causes a heart attack. If we look at your relative risk for having a cardiac event, if you're in the second or third tercile for LDL versus the third, of course it rises, but it rises a lot more with oxidized LDL. Oxidized LDL is a strong predictor of a rising IMT, which in turn reflects an increased predisposition to disease progression and event rate. So we need to block LDL oxidation. So I learned about oxidative stress 20 to 25 years ago from this guy, Terry Chappell, who practices in Bluffton, Ohio. Now, at this time, 25 years ago, I spent all my time in the hospital, and I was actually tied at age 35 with two older guys as the leading admitter of cardiovascular patients to my primary hospital. The coronary care unit had 8 beds, and one Tuesday afternoon, 25 years ago, between 2 and 4 in the afternoon, all of all 8 charts corresponding to those patients had a blue sticker showing they were Robert's patients. I spent all my time taking care of crises, doing invasive procedures. I was sort of a master of cardiovascular disaster. But I wasn't doing anything to prevent this disease. And then one day, this little old lady got admitted to me with a small heart attack. I did her heart cath, and all 3 vessels were blocked. And I advised her to undergo bypass surgery before she left the hospital. And that was a fairly bold recommendation because at that time, the standard was to medicate the patient, have them go home and recover, and have their bypass surgery a month later because surgical anesthesia then was not as well developed as it is today, and the mortality with acute heart attack surgery was quite high. But the blockages were so tight that I was really worried about this lady, and I said, you need to have the bypass surgery. She didn't want to do it, so I said, ma'am, if you don't have bypass surgery before you leave the hospital, you're going to die. Well, she listened politely and declined my recommendation and went home, and I put her on a beta blocker, propranolol. I saw her in the office a few weeks later, and I told her, I hope you've made up your mind to have surgery because you're at risk of death. Well, no, I need a little bit more time. My family's coming in. Well, okay, take this diltiazem. I saw her a month later, and I told her that she was going to die without bypass surgery. Oh, I just need to wait a little bit longer. So I would see her periodically and tell her that she was going to die without bypass surgery. And then about 2 years later, I was going in to see her, and I was getting ready to tell her she was going to die without bypass surgery, and it dawned on me that she was not dead. In fact, she looked really good, and she wasn't taking my medicine. I go, ma'am, I was so worried about you, and I thought you needed heart surgery, and you're doing so well, I don't understand. He goes, well, Dr. Roberts, you seem like a fine young man. I don't want to upset you, but when I went and I got chelation therapy. Huh? Chelation therapy, it doesn't work. Well, Dr. Roberts, you just said I was doing well. She was. She had gone to Dr. Chapel behind my back and got chelation therapy and got better. As it turns out, a handful of my patients were going down to Dr. Chapel and getting better, and they all kind of fessed up and they told me about it. And gee, I was told by my professors that chelation didn't work. But all these patients with advanced heart disease are undergoing chelation and they're getting better. So I called Dr. Chapel up and I asked him, well, what are you doing? You know,
so that's a really good story, because this is actually where a physician, I'm proud to like hear these stories where physicians go, okay, yeah, I was taught this and taught wrong things in medical school, and yet explore it as their patients. As a patient, you have the right to go do the research yourself and go see other practitioners and choose a more less aggressive route in your health and make lifestyle changes and do chelation and do things that are actually going to benefit your body and be less invasive. And so this is why this channel exists, to give you hope, to give you information. And let's just go a little bit more of what he has to say. Maybe let's get to an area where I know it's a lot of science. This is a lot of science about stress and the markers. And he says he has like this freaking 2 hour long lecture, but it's really cool. So just listen a little bit more.
Prevention, not primary prevention. We will use pharmaceutical approaches. Why not? So we're making superoxide. Mother Nature generates superoxide. She had to come up with a means of neutralizing, detoxifying superoxide, and that is superoxide dismutase that dismutates or neutralizes superoxide into hydrogen peroxide. We have SOD1, which is in the cytoplasm, the cell fluid, SOD2, which is in the mitochondria, our fuel cells, SOD3, which is on the vascular wall. The hydrogen peroxide will be converted to water and oxygen by catalase, glutathione peroxidase, and peroxyredoxins. This is Mother Nature's primary defense against free radicals. Now, some of the free radicals may break through, and thus we have our secondary defense, which are antioxidant vitamins and minerals, which we can obtain from diet or via supplementation. One problem, many of us are genomically downregulated in our ability to handle free radicals. And I routinely measure this in my patients, and most of my patients with cardiovascular disease harbor downregulations in our antioxidant defense molecules. And this was a good idea 1,000 years ago, because we weren't dealing with toxins. We didn't have mercury fillings. We weren't exposed to lead or cadmium or aluminum, but we were fighting microbes. And if you were good at making free radicals and bad at neutralizing free radicals, you had more bullets to kill the microbes. So this was adaptive for primitive man. It's maladaptive for modern man. So some of us who are particularly weak at neutralizing free radicals were the canaries in the coal mine. We get sick while the individuals who are genetically intact do not. We get sicker at a younger age in life. And you also need mineral cofactors. Superoxide dismutase, to function adequately, needs manganese and zinc and selenium. Glutathione peroxidase needs iodine. We tend to be low in minerals. I will check this in my patients. Those of you who are experiencing oxidative stress, you've depleted your manganese, your selenium, and zinc. Now, this is a big deal. If you look at the relationship between serum selenium and the number of vessels that are blocked, you know, if you have high selenium, you're clear. As selenium levels fall, you have more vascular disease because you have weak antioxidant defenses. And our vitamin antioxidant defenses are interacting. Ascorbic acid, vitamin C, is our primary water-soluble antioxidant. Vitamin E is our primary intracellular fat soluble antioxidant, and vitamin C will recycle vitamin E, and coenzyme Q and lipoic acid play a role here. So we have a teamwork, an interlocking vitamin-based antioxidant defense system to deal with any superoxide or hydrogen peroxide that breaks through our primary enzyme-based antioxidant defense barriers. There are many different sources of oxidative stress, and we need a team of antioxidants. So I liken this to a football team. What bothers me a lot is someone will come in and they're drinking this fruit juice from Southeast Asia that the Queen of England thought was a good idea, whatever, and it's all you need to do. And it's well and good. It's going to be rich in bioflavonoids, but we need a team of antioxidants. So you could take all the fruit juice you want, or you could take 1,000 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q, but if you're low in manganese, selenium, and zinc, the free radicals are going to break through. This would be like having a football team with several all-stars and a couple linemen with broken legs. The bad guys will find a way to break through. This is why we want to do nutritional testing. And this is why in the TAC study, we put you on a broad spectrum vitamin mineral program to cover all these bases. And this is very important because if superoxide and peroxide break through our defenses, myeloperoxidase will convert peroxide into hypochlorous acid, which is like bleach. And that's good to kill microbes, but you don't want to be bleaching your organs. Superoxide will react with nitric oxide to form peroxynitrate, which leads to endothelial dysfunction. The big problem is that heavy metals will catalyze the Fenton reaction that converts superoxide or peroxide into hydroxyl, which is 1,000 times more damaging than is superoxide. This is how heavy metals are bothering us. Any free radicals that break through, their toxicity is magnified 1,000-fold. So we're experiencing free radical overload, superoxide generated by xanthine oxidase, angiotensin converting enzyme, NADPH oxidase. Superoxide needs to be neutralized by superoxide dismutase, catalase, and glutathione peroxidase. If not, we get peroxynitrite, hypochlorous acid, or hydroxyl. And this is where metals are a problem. High iron and high copper will catalyze the Fenton reaction to make hydroxyl. This is why if your ferritin level is high, I will recommend that you get blood, because excess iron acts just like lead and promotes oxidative stress. High ferritin increases cardiac risk. High LDL increases cardiac risk. High ferritin with high LDL synergizes to dramatically increase cardiac risk. And cadmium, lead, mercury, and aluminum are all promoting the conversion of superoxide and peroxide into damaging hydroxyl. We've got to get this stuff out of us. If not, we have oxidative stress. We go out of balance. We have inflammation. We have endothelial dysfunction. We have cardiovascular disease. Because oxidative stress is interpreted by our body as infection, so we're going to ramp up this process. We get hyperglycemia, hyperlipidemia, immune dysregulation, endothelial dysfunction, and cardiovascular disease. This response is appropriate to real infection, but it's inappropriate to a 50-year pseudo-infection where the body misidentifies oxidized LDL within the RE wall as a microbe. What are the mechanisms of metal toxicity? Well, oxidative stress, cofactor depletion, enzyme dysfunction, and there's a synergy between toxins. Multiple metals, interaction with organic pollutants. There was an animal model where you give an animal the LDL 10 of lead. That's enough lead to kill 10% of the animals. Then the LDL 10 of mercury. That's enough mercury to kill 10% of the animals. Then you give them the LDL 10 and the LDL of mercury, you get LDL 100, because different metals will compromise different steps in our metabolism. The more metals that we're exposed to, the more likely we are to have a problem. Plus, the metals will interact with organic pollutants as well. Now, metals destroy enzymes. They gum up the lock and they throw away the key. So enzymes participate in an assembly line process to generate new molecules. So the enzyme will grab a substrate and an energy source such as ATP. It will catalyze the phosphorylation of the substrate to create ADP and a finished product that is then processed by another enzyme. The open active site of the enzyme will catalyze the next step will catalyze another substrate. Well, if we have metals, they will bind to the sulfhydryl group in the active site of the enzyme, and like a key that doesn't fit in the lock, it just gets stuck and it kills the enzyme. The enzyme can no longer carry out its biochemical activities. It will be degraded. You make new enzyme, which is then poisoned by metals. So metals will gum up our enzyme system and compromise our biology. Mercury will inhibit methionine synthase, and thus you'll deplete your SAMe. If you don't have SAMe, S-adenosylmethionine, COMT, catecholamethyltransferase, cannot break down adrenaline. So those of you with mercury fillings or to eating a lot of fish, over the years, you're going to bring up mercury. You'll take in a lot of mercury. You can't break down adrenaline. So your blood pressure rises. All of a sudden, you can't drink coffee and you're stress intolerant because you're no longer able to break down adrenaline because of a mercury burden. Cobalt is quite toxic. It binds to sulfhydryl groups in lipoic acid and compromises our biology. So in World War II, cobalt was used in munitions, and the workers were grinding the cobalt, and they got a hypersensitive.
Okay, he has so much information. I'm going to go a little further, and then I'm going to end it, because I really, if you're geeked out, you can listen to the whole thing. But what I got from it is, because man, oh man, chelation can save lives, and we aren't using it. And could you be doing something to help remove those metals that are in your body? I remember having just recently, past 6 months, as I went and saw a holistic dentist, and was working to get all the mercury out of my mouth, and he just looked at me straight, naturopath, the dentist, who said, "You're mercury poisoned." And so I have been working very hard on chelating and doing things to remove these heavy metals out of my body. Particular mercury. I'm sure I have lead too, and that's what I started some products with, some EDTA.
Search, we took it down to 10. And now we would say that 10 is enough, that 10 is safe. In adults, 95% is stored in bone, and our bone lead level is now 100 times greater than it was 100 years ago. And lead is associated with hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and kidney disease. Cardiovascular risk of, quote, normal blood lead levels, as if there's anything really normal about having these toxins. Primitive man didn't have any of these toxins. Saying there's a normal level is sort of an excuse to say we don't have to do anything about it. We do not have to be responsible stewards of our body. Now, a blood lead level above 10 is associated with an increased risk of neurologic disease in kids. Everybody would admit to this. Blood level less than 10 in kids is considered normal. Don't worry about it. But kids with a level of 10 have an IQ 7.5 points below kids with a level of 0 to 1. 7.5 IQ points is huge. That's the difference between a job that requires cognitive function, where you're going to contribute to society, like a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, and a job that does not require cognitive integrity, where you're not going to be contributing to society, such as being like a Medicare administrator. And of course, you know, I gave this talk to doctors, so everybody got a chuckle out of that one. Now, a blood level of above 10 is associated with an increased cardiovascular risk in adults. 99% of U.S. adults now have blood lead levels below 10 because we took it out of gas and out of tin cans. But if kids are not okay with a level below 10, is there an increased cardiovascular risk in adults at a lead level below 10, between 1 and 10? So what we're going to do here, we're going to take just over 1,400 adult participants in the third NHANES study. This is the National Health and Nutrition Education Survey. Record at baseline your standard cardiovascular risk factors and blood lead. You're going to exclude the minority of the patients, 707, with blood levels above 10. And we're going to look at just below 1,400 who had quote unquote normal levels. The mean level was 2.58. The first tercile, the lower third, was 0 to 1.9. The middle tercile is 1.9 to 3.6. The third tercile was anything above 3.6. We're going to record mortality and cause of mortality over the following 12 years. Does a quote unquote normal range lead affect long-term mortality? Now, if we look at all-cause mortality relative risk, being in the middle tercile did not increase your risk, but if you were in the upper third, you were 30% more likely to die over the follow-up period. If you were in the middle tercile, your cardiovascular death risk rose 6%, but if you were in the third tercile, above 3.6, you rose 64%. Death due to myocardial infarction, 5% or 100% risk. You were twice as likely to die of myocardial infarction if you're in the third tercile. Stroke mortality, and stroke is linked more to high blood pressure than with heart attack, and lead causes high blood pressure. It's a cause of high blood pressure. If you're in the middle tercile versus the third, you're 2.2 times as likely. In the third tercile, you're 2.6 times as likely to die of stroke as individuals with lower lead levels. And why is this occurring? Because lead causes oxidative stress. If we look at your relative risk for a future event, if you're in the second or third tercile for LDL versus the third, your risk rises. But if it's oxidized LDL, your risk skyrockets. Lead leads to oxidative stress, leads to cardiovascular disease, leads to hypertension, increased risk of heart attack and stroke mortality. That makes sense. Lead and hypertension in men. What is the mechanism? 33 men, age 28 to 58, 25 were exposed to lead for weeks to months. They were welders, they were metal cutters, and they would monitor lead blood levels in the workplace. And if their lead level got high, they were taken away from the workplace and they were returned when their blood lead level returned to normal, which is a big mistake because it's not being excreted from the body, it's entering your cells. So if you take them off work for a month, their blood levels normal. That's because it's all in their cells. That was a bad idea. But anyways, that was their practice. And then you look at 8 non-exposed workers. We're going to measure labs pertaining to the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, the RAAS. Now, what you see here, you can see this is a very old study because we had to photocopy the graph. Lead correlates exponentially with renin. Renin is released by the kidney and leads to the generation of angiotensin 1. The kidney will release renin in response to oxidative stress or impaired blood flow. Lead causes oxidative stress, vasoconstriction. The kidney releases renin. Then angiotensin 1 correlates linearly with renin and exponentially with lead. ACE, angiotensin-converting enzyme, correlates linearly with angiotensin 1 and exponentially with lead. Aldosterone, this is a hormone released by the adrenal that retains sodium and water and wastes potassium and magnesium, correlates linearly with lead. So lead led to activation of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. You're making more aldosterone, you're making more angiotensin 2. That causes oxidative stress, vasoconstriction, salt and water reduction, retention, and hypertension. So lead is linked with hypertension in men. Adult blood lead levels have dropped by 90% over the past 20 years. But that doesn't mean that it's out of our body. It's locked into our cells. 95% of our lead is in bone. Once it's in, it's pretty much locked in forever. The Normal of Aging study looked at bone lead, which is an index of body burden, and it rises steadily with age in men. As your bone lead, your body burden of lead rises from 8 to 37. The first to fifth quintiles, your risk for hypertension rises by 50%. In women, the relationship is more important and more complex. As you go from the first to the fourth quartile for lead, in premenopausal women, your relative risk for hypertension rises. In postmenopausal women, the relationship is even stronger. Why? With bone loss, with menopause, old lead and cadmium comes rushing out into your circulation. So that's one of the reasons your blood pressure rises with menopause. When seniors fall and break a bone, they tend to fall apart. When you break your hip, you fall apart. And we go, well, gee, that's because they're going to be infirm for a period of time. And indeed, that's the case. But it also may be that when you break a big bone, a bunch of lead and cadmium and other metals rush out to compromise your biology. Serum creatinine rises as a sign of kidney dysfunction. And it rises in relation to blood lead. Creatinine tends to rise with age as a result of of an age-related decline in kidney function, which is not pathologic, but if you're in the fourth quartile for lead, it rises more rapidly and severely than if you have a lower lead burden, because lead is toxic to the kidney. Let's talk about cadmium. Again, we get cadmium from smoking tobacco, nickel cadmium batteries, welding and zinc smelting, metal coatings, foodstuff, shellfish. It was in long fungicides until 97. Golfers would get sick from cadmium, and your mother. It readily traverses the placenta. So if your mom smoked, you were born with a huge cadmium burden, and the half-life is 20 years. That means if you have a given burden of cadmium and you stop taking in cadmium, for your cadmium level to fall by 50%, it'll take 20 years. So once it's there pretty much forever. Cadmium and hypertension. I have a number of patients in my practice that live in Kansas City, and that's because Caroline Reiser practiced in Kansas City. Caroline Reiser was the best Lyme and chronic infection doctor in the United States. She's retired recently, but she would send me patients, and they'd be sitting in the waiting room interacting with my Toledo patients, and inevitably they'd have a conversation, and the Toledo patient would say, you know, I like Dr. Roberts. I like the way he practices medicine. That's why I'm here. But like, you live in Kansas City. Don't you've got cardiologists in Kansas City. And the guy from Kansas City would say, well, cardiologists in Kansas City, with my case, they've gone about as far as they could go. And the city fathers of Kansas City have gone about as far as they can go to increase the business activity of the cardiovascular community. Hard water is usually protective against hypertension cardiovascular disease, but not in Kansas City, Kansas. Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri draw their water from the same source, but in Kansas City, Kansas, the water is twice as hard as the softened water in Kansas City, Missouri, but they did something wrong in Kansas City, Kansas. They introduced cadmium to their water, and their serum cadmium level is tenfold greater in Kansas City, Kansas than is Kansas City, Missouri. So they have high blood pressure, more heart disease. Great place to practice cardiology, by the way. So let's look at cadmium and risk of myocardial infarction, heart attack. Just under 5,000 adult participants in the Third and Haynes study recorded baseline, your standard risk factors, urine cadmium, not bone cadmium, not provoked cadmium, but urine cadmium, because this was an easy assessment to make. And in this large national study, they needed to do easy assessments. Presence of prior infarction, that's heart attack. They divide the urine cadmium into the first, middle, and third terciles. Nothing here was considered pathologic. This is the normal levels of cadmium in the population. Correlate cadmium burden with risk factor adjusted myocardial infarction risk. Does cadmium increase risk for heart attack? And of course it does. Now, we get most of our cadmium from smoking. And if you look at men and women, never smokers, former smokers, current smokers, cadmium will rise. So the former smokers have a cadmium burden that's not going to go away for 20 years. And the current smokers have an old cadmium burden, and each time they smoke, they're introducing more cadmium. So, of course, they would have higher levels.
All right. So most of you, my listeners, I know don't smoke. We're going to go a little further in his and kind of wrap it up to – there we go. And I hope that maybe this is sparking some interest with you when it comes to – removing heavy metals and how important it is. Okay, here we go.
These are without kidney disease, were older. These were younger people, and the younger you are, the less time on the planet you have to accumulate metals. These folks would have a lower toxic burden. You're going to measure blood and urine lead, and urine lead over 72 hours following 1,000 milligrams of EDHA. Above 600 was considered a high lead burden. Below 600 was considered a normal or expected burden. So blood lead levels in the healthy controls was similar to that of the younger people with chronic kidney disease of a known etiology. But if we look at blood lead, it rises. High blood pressure with renal insufficiency, high blood pressure with renal insufficiency and gout, that would make sense. The non-provoked urine lead was pretty much the same in the controls and the hypertensives. It was lower in the chronic renal insufficiency with known ideology because they were younger people. The younger you are, the less lead you're going to accumulate. You're going to have lower levels in the blood and in the urine. But a non-provoked urine lead level really is reflecting the lead in your blood that day. What is entering from your cells or what you're getting in from diet and water. So the non-provoked lead was not telling, but the post-EDHA provoked lead level, which is what is in your soft tissues, what is in your kidney right now, you go from controls, hypertension, hypertension with renal involvement, hypertension with renal involvement in gout, you can see they have much more lead in their soft tissues, in their kidney, suggesting that lead is a key player in their kidney function. Bone lead, which is total body burden, was greater in those with a high post-EDHA spill than in the controls. So a high spill after EDHA is not just soft tissue, but body burden and bone. Delta ALA is an enzyme that is activated specifically in response to lead overload. It's a biomarker of lead overload. It was also greater in those that had a high spill. So the blood level doesn't mean a lot. The unprovoked urine level doesn't mean a lot, but a high provoked urine level means a lot. It means you have a soft tissue burden. It means your biology is compromised. It means your total body burden is increased. So a high lead burden is not common in healthy controls, chronic renal insufficiency of known etiology, younger subjects. A high lead burden is seen in 15% of hypertensives, 44% of those with hypertension and renal involvement, 68% of those with renal insufficiency, hypertension, and gout. A high lead burden correlates with increasing creatinine, elevated delta ALA, elevated bone lead. Blood lead level is not helpful in diagnosis. Use a Broca challenge. I never measure blood lead levels. They're worthless. It's a dumb idea. If a patient comes to me and they have this blood lead level that their doctor did and said, gee, you're not lead toxic, I immediately come to an understanding that that doctor does not understand heavy metal overload. We have to do a provocative challenge to measure what is in your soft tissues. Chronic renal insufficiency itself is not the cause of an elevated lead burden. Lead is etiologic. It's causative in a large percentage of patients with chronic renal insufficiency. Lead chelation is of universal value in chronic renal insufficiency. Someday, the FDA will approve chelation therapy in chronic kidney disease and in chronic cardiovascular disease, and then Medicare and insurance companies will start paying for it. We're going to put chelation therapy in the hands of primary care doctors. We will dramatically decrease our hypertensive burden, the need for dialysis, and the need for cardiovascular interventions. But I'm doing this right now. 64-year-old man with hypertension and kidney dysfunction. His blood pressure was normal on lisinopril, an ACE inhibitor, and hydrochlorothiazide, a diuretic. His creatinine's elevated at 1.5, and normal is like 1.1 to 1.2. His renal ultrasound was normal. He did not have obstructive kidney disease from a kidney stone or enlarged prostate. We do a provocative challenge. We give him EDHA, DMSA, and DMPS, and I see a lead burden. I don't see mercury. I see lead, so I'm going to treat him with EDHA, our most powerful lead detoxifier. So we treat him. He gets 20 treatments, and we get him off the drugs. His blood pressure normalizes. His post-provocative challenge lead spill falls. Just like in the study, we cleaned out the soft tissue. His kidneys got better and his blood pressure got better. And we can do this all the time. Now, if a patient does not have a lead burden or a cadmium burden, then chelation won't help, but just about everybody does. And to find out, we do a provocative challenge. And if we see the metals, we will clean them out. Heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury, arsenic, nickel, and aluminum are not normally present in the human body. No beneficial role in human physiology. They're pure toxins. There's no normal level. It's just that some of us aren't yet sick from metals. You know, a healthy American is someone who hasn't yet been diagnosed with autoimmune disease, heart disease, or cancer. The metals are ubiquitous in the environment of modern man. It's a new development. Mother Nature provides us with no defense against them. Mechanisms of toxicity, oxidative stress, endothelial dysfunction, displaced nutritional metals, inactivates enzyme systems. So how do we treat metal-induced pathophysiology? We'll limit ongoing exposure. If you smoke, stop smoking. If you got mercury fillings, we got to get rid of these things. If you have high ferritin, which acts physiologically like lead and cadmium and mercury, you give blood to the Red Cross. That's good for society. There's nothing wrong with your blood, but you don't want that iron. So if you give blood, your bone marrow will have to make new red cells, and you'll use up your iron, and you'll lower your iron stores. Change your personal environment. Do your very best to limit toxins. Now, I know you can't all go live in the woods in a hut, but do your best to change your personal environment. Some of you who I don't like a whole lot, I wish you would go off to the woods and live in a hut, but the rest of you, my patients and friends, I want you to stick around. Evaluate the level of oxidative stress. Look at your antioxidant defenses. We can do nutritional testing, genomic testing, look at our detox defenses, and assess your toxic burden. How do we do that? Some practitioners use hair analysis, but that's what the body can excrete. And many people are so toxic you cannot excrete it in the hair. And I think it's also heavily weighted towards recent exposure, not body burden. I don't think it correlates with what's in your bone. Standard laboratory is not helpful. Blood lead is recent exposure. Urine lead is recent exposure more than cellular burden. Red blood cell lead is 2 to 3 month exposure, kind of like a hemoglobin A1C. It's a useful guide, but if I don't see it in your red cells, that doesn't mean it's not in your kidneys and your liver and in your arteries and your heart. Organ biopsy would be great. If I could biopsy your liver, I would know. But lead concentrates variably in our internal organs, and most of it is in bone. So we would have to do a bone biopsy, which we're not going to do. Provoked urine metal levels is the best indicator of soft tissue intracellular metal burden. And then physician training, judgment, experience is important. I've been doing this for 20 years. I probably have a more extensive experience in chelation therapy than does any other cardiologist in the United States. And that's because I'm older and I have gray hair. And I participate in the training of cardiologists, non-cardiologists in chelation, and I'm involved in the chelation therapy research. So how do we carry out this urine-provoked metal assessment? We administer to you a panel of chelators.
Okay, so then he goes into this whole thing about what they do to test and how they test. And I think when you talk to people that have done the testing, it is people in a certain age group over 40, I think they're just so high of people having heavy metals from just accumulating and causing issues. So we started a couple new products in our household and with some EDTA, alpha lipoic acid, and glutathione, increasing glutathione and making sure our minerals are up. I really, 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 really love magnesium lotion, magnesium soaks, but not Epsom salt, but other things that work. And we'll tell you our own personal experience with kind of doing this on our own and not working with a healthcare practitioner or not doing IV chelation. I think IV chelation would be awesome. And this video was so long ago, and yes, it would save money and it would help people if they would have it. It's just Big Pharma doesn't want that. They wouldn't make much money. It doesn't cost a lot to do this. So I wonder if we'll ever see it in the U.S., but in other countries. So just an interesting concept. If you want to listen to this 2-hour lecture, I will give you the link, but I hope this tickled your ears about heavy metal and kidney and heart disease.